open public hearing in House Bill 2008, House Bill 2020, and call off by Brian DeLashmit and Christina Squires. Pinch hitting for Jim Green.
Yeah.
Who apparently has been ill this week. I trust it wasn't the first discussion that made him so.
We wouldn't do that, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Brian DeLashmit. The first portion of what I'm going to talk about is basically the update, and that's why my colleague is joining me at the table. When we left you last, of the 22 issues, we had an agreement on 18 issues. We've worked for roughly 16 plus hours at this point, besides meetings internally, the employers and the employees meeting separately, but face-to-face been roughly 16 to 17 hours. I must give you at least one caveat about the 18 issues that I reported to you last time. There was a transcription mistake on one issue. It's an issue that I know is near and dear to some of your hearts. But there was an agreement, I believe there was an agreement on legislators not in the new system, and actually there was a difference of opinion on what we agreed to. Some of us said legislators are not in PNF in the new system if they're in the new system, and other ones said, no, legislators all the way out of the new system. I know you have other bills to deal with that, but I just want to make that notation. That's one of the 18 that I had mentioned before, and I've been corrected by my colleagues on what the agreement actually was. Now, starting up, unless you want me to go back through the 18 issues or the 17 issues of actual agreement, I would just as soon very quickly begin on the four remaining issues. I've kind of tried to group them in a manner that I think makes some sense. I did not mention those four specific items at our last hearing. Because I wanted to have the employers and the employees wanted to have some flexibility to talk about these issues without some external pressures. Given the time constraints that we've been given, and I understand that, Mr. Chair, I think it's probably appropriate at this point that we roll out those four additional items and then give you some of the information that we found out as we explored those. And then look for further instructions from you and the committee as to whether you want us to continue, you don't want us to continue, you want us to try and redefine some of the areas of discord or what your actual pleasure is. So with that, let me start in the four remaining issues. The first one is, I think, more, it's not as hard of a philosophical difference as it is a technical issue. And it's the issue of the 600-hour rule. And let me explain that a little bit further. Currently under PERS, there's a 600-hour rule, and an employer, obviously, until an employee reaches the 600 hours in a year, that employee is not technically qualified for PERS for the payment. There is some situations in which they may work less than that number of hours, but for multiple employers, therefore they, in fact, are having more than 600 hours, and do qualify. And there's some discussion in a couple of areas around this, and let me talk about it. The first is the ability for the employers and PERS and the employees to know when that 600-hour rule is being exceeded if there's multiple employers involved. One employer may not know that they're working for another employer and how many hours. There's the uncertainty of the PERS system knowing what information they're getting on the hours or not getting. And given the computer constraints that they have, it's my understanding that it's a very labor-intensive issue for them. So there was concern about that. On the employee side, there is a concern that employers, in order to be able to avoid in a new system, to be able to avoid paying a PERS benefit, would intentionally devise a structure for an employee, let's say, for example, a school janitor or a cook, a system in which that would intentionally keep them under 600 hours so they wouldn't have to pay the benefit, but yet this would be a permanent part-time person. This person may work 30 straight years, but they're constructed in such a way that they come under the 600-hour rules, which some of our folks, actually all of our folks feel is $600 in itself is somewhat of an arbitrary figure. So that's the one part of that. On the employees or the employer's side, they not only had the first issue about multiple employers in the reporting piece, but they had concerns about people that in fact may come back to them repeatedly. For example, I think the discussion was around a library aide who comes back, wants to work, may either have already retired from something else and doesn't have any expectation of retirement benefits under PERS, and how do you deal with that? So that's the one area that I guess I would say we would punt on right now, but I think they're given some perhaps some technical advice on what some other states are doing, and maybe the PERS's staff expertise, we could probably work through that particular issue. That's not as much a philosophical issue on where we're at. The next one that I'll talk about is disability. The discussions that we had to this point centered on disability in two frames. One is disability on the job, and one is disability off the job. And it's my understanding, without being an expert, I rely on Pat West from the firefighters on disability, but it's my understanding in the current PERS system that there really is no differentiation between on the job and off the job as far as disability in itself and what your payment is. We had a number of discussions about disability, and the issue of disability, I think, is resolvable as a part of the entire package that we're talking about. We are willing to look at a differentiation between on-the-job disability versus off-the-job disability. The other issue that the employers, and I hope I'm not taking all of your comments, but the other issue for the employers was, is it the responsibility of an employer to, in fact, have disability equal to an on-the-job disability if, in fact, somebody is disabled while water skiing or snow skiing on a weekend, and is the PERS response, PERS system's responsibility and the employer's responsibility to do that coverage. So we've had that discussion. The other issue is the ability, and I know we've talked about it in front of the committee at some point, is the ability to differentiate between PERS itself and PERS disability as far as the rate. Because when you're comparing PERS as a retirement system versus someone in another state's retirement system or a private retirement system with a disability component in there, it in fact is not an apples to apples comparison. So there was a lot of discussion about how do you construct this in such a way. In fact, there is a disability component, but they're really billed separately, and you can differentiate between the retirement portion and the disability portion, and I don't believe there's disagreement on that particular piece. The next piece that I would report on is the issue of the ability for a current employer who is a part of the PERS system. We call it opt-out of a new system, and they call it opt-into a new system, because if you start a new system, does it start from point zero, and then everybody gets to decide whether they want for the new employer to be into the new system, or is there an assumption that everybody is currently in Tier 1 and Tier 2 as far as employers? In fact, then it's a continuation, and we're setting up a new system for their new employees, and it should be the ability to opt out. We did not have a resolution on that, but let me indicate that we spent more time on disability and the fourth piece and didn't spend as much time on that particular discussion. It was an issue that we talked about, didn't have a resolution, and went on to some other issues. The last one, of course, which is everybody knows is the big one, is I would kind of frame it in, I use the term replacement ratios, but it comes in several different forms. If we're talking about, and we are talking about, a defined benefit plan, full formula, straight calculation, then there are a number of factors that were of interest. What is the replacement of salary? What percentage of replacement of salary is your goal at the end? And then, of course, using the number of years of service, what is the multiplier? And we did have discussions about that. I will go through in a minute. I'll kind of end and let Hasina talk about anything on this that needs to be cleaned up. And then I'll talk about the run that was handed out and what that looked like and what that plan looked like. But the age of the retirees that are able to retire without the years of service, the 25 and 30 or whatever is agreed on, that was still up in the air. Whether it's the same age of retirement that's under Tier 2 currently or whether or not that age would need to be optioned up. And the last issue under this particular topic area is the issue of shared responsibility. And we had substantial discussions about not only the issue of which we had agreement on whether or not the employers and the employees were both going to pay into a defined benefit plan, but the shared responsibility in terms of as rates fluctuate up and down, what's the shared responsibility and the shared benefit to both the employer and the employee as that moves. Pause here for kind of putting on a different hat. Let me talk about a couple of different things that we found out that surprised me a little bit. We did several cost runs, and there was a dynamic when I'm transitioning out of the talk about shared responsibility that I don't think any of us realize that occurs. And that's the, by accident, we had a run that was an equal distribution of the percentage payroll shared by the employer and the employee, and that was higher than obviously what we had been advocating as the employees, which is 6%, and then the employer pays the 8 or whatever that figure is. And the run ran on running 7 point whatever for both sides, and when that came back, we looked at the bottom number as to what the actual total rate was, and the total rate changed. And logically, you would think it wouldn't make any difference who was paying it. As long as the rate was the same rate, why would that change? And after I had a discussion with PERS staff and also Mark Johnson, it became apparent that there's a dynamic that none of us would have thought about, which is for those employees who don't vest and draw their money back out, the more money or more percentage they'd be putting in on the front side, the more money they're drawing out, the less money there is in the account to draw interest over time to pay the ultimate benefit at the end. And that was a real interesting dynamic. So we're all learning things as we're going, and I hope we're able to share that with all of you as we go. The other thing that we did, which I think was a valuable exercise, the employers asked us, given the parameters of the plan, the 18 points that we had talked about before, what is the dynamic, and I know this goes to a question that Representative Richardson asks a lot about assumed rates over extended periods of time, what is the dynamic or the impact on the rate in the plan that we were proposing? Of instead of an 8% assumed rate, which has been pretty constant over a number of years, if you were only over 40 years able to achieve 7%, and we did that run, or actually estimate from Mark Johnson, and also on the 9%, saying, okay, what is the, in essence, what we were trying to get at is, what is the flexibility of the rate? If there are is primarily, without any bells and whistles, a major driver in a defined benefit plan like we've been looking at, it is the market and the market returns. So what we were told was that it's approximately a 20%, not 20% rate, it's 20% of whatever the initial rate is on the 8%. So given what I'll talk about here in a little while after we pause, if you assume that the average rate under the plan that we were proposing was 14.81, then 20% flux of that would be an upper limit of about 17.8% combined, that's employer and employee, and on the bottom end it was 11.88, and my numbers may be slightly wrong. I was doing it out in the hallway by longhand, you know, my old grade school division and addition. So that was an interesting exercise for us to know what impact that major assumption shift would make on the ultimate rate. With that, I'll pause and...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Hastina Squires, I'm here today on behalf of the Special District Association of Oregon, Association of Oregon Counties, Oregon School Boards Association, and League of Oregon Cities. We have had a tremendous amount of discussion around the table and have just do have some outstanding issues. Brian outlined four of them for you. On the 600, I'd just like to add just a few things. On the 600-hour rule, there's a lot of discussion. We really tried to focus more on other issues other than what we call the smaller issues. They're all big issues, but some of them much smaller than others. So the 600-hour rule, we did have a very lively discussion about it. It is possible that we could reach some sort of consensus. I think from the employer perspective, we are very interested in finding a way for PERS and our employers to better track who's working where and at what time, and in a manner that is not as cumbersome as it's currently being done and costly at the existing level with PERS. The disability issue, I think, is a huge issue that is still outstanding. I don't think that we have explored that nearly enough. It is a very, very big issue for police and fire and also for general service, and I think that there's a lot more discussion that needs to take place regarding that issue, and we recognize that. The issue that Brian alluded to in the very beginning, where we were transposing memories about what we agreed to and what we didn't agree to with legislators in or out of the plan, the employer coalition is very, very, very strongly feels that legislators should be out of the plan. And we have disagreement with amongst us on what we agreed to, and we're fine with that, and it's an issue that needs to be revisited.
Brian, actually, I just want to know, was this a cheap attempt for the unions to try to get legislators to unionize? Is that why you're in favor of us staying in the plan? Or?
Mr. Chair, I don't need any additional clients.
All right. Just checking.
Mr. Chair, I can vouch for that. There was no discussion of unionizing the legislature. And the issue of opting in or opting out, however you want to characterize it, we characterize it as the ability to choose to get into this new successor plan or choose to do something other than this new successor plan for hire, so we call it opting in, is still another big outstanding issue. And with that, I'll just close by saying we have been talking.
Now, with that, if I may, Mr. Chair, the three-page document. This is a different role. I'm no longer the recording secretary for the group, and I am. What I handed out was the employees' plan on how to deal with the remaining issues, with the exception, obviously, of the 600-hour rule. But this did deal with the replacement ratio, the disability issue, and we had a run done. And I think it's very important to point out, obviously the assumptions are on the first page, the first eight, and then, of course, all of the actuarial disclaimers are the next page and a half. But I do want to let you know that in discussions with Mark Johnson, this was a full run. This was not just an estimate. What they had done for the Millennium Hall Group was an estimate of about 100 different scenarios. In many cases, those numbers were doing what Mark called shortcuts and coming to their percentages. In this case, they did a full run, both on the first run when we had done earlier in the week that came back, and then this ultimate run. This plan, if you turn to the final page, third page, which is the comparison, has several things of note. The first is that the overall cost of disability is down because the employees did acknowledge some need to change the off-duty disability under PERS. At the same time, there was a discussion by the employees of a need to beef up the on-the-job disability portion, which currently is inequitable based upon your actual age and years of service. You can have two firefighters, they get hurt in the exact same accident, and based upon the age in which they started their service and how long they had to go until they were able to retire, would get two totally different benefits. And so we were looking at a consistent benefit based upon the injury of those two. So we have made a suggestion to slightly beef up the employer side, or I mean the on-the-job side, but yet acknowledge a downward payout on the off-the-job disability. And that did have some impact lowering the disability portion. The other thing that I would note, obviously total system, if you look at the highlighted halfway through that chart, total system current Tier 2, 15.82. The employer portion of that is 9.82. The proposal that we have put in front of you is total is 14.84. Employer side, if the employee pickup is 6%, or portion is 6%, the employer portion is 8.84%. So you can see that we have dropped it a full percentage point below what Tier 2 is, and keep in mind that my understanding is this is the current Tier 2 rate. This is not the Tier 2 rate that we'd be going to, barring substantial changes in the session proposed legislation. So it could, in fact, amount a new plan. If all of those things don't go into effect, this could amount to multiple percentages, not just 1%. The other thing that I would close on is that the plan that we've put in front of you has very few drivers as far as costs, because it does not include unused sick leave. It does include vacation, and it does have a COLA on it. That's about it. It has a disability component, obviously, that could be separated out, what we talked about. But the primary driver in this system that we talked about earlier before is the returns, and we did the run of 7% return and 9% run and found out that the fluctuation is only 20% on each end. So it's a very stable plan as far as the rate that we think was one of the major goals when both the employers and the employees tried to get together, was how do you have a new system that's sustainable, has a stable rate with very little rate fluctuation, and make it as simple as possible. And we believe this is a very simple plan. It is very rate stable, and we've accomplished our goals. And with that, I'd answer any questions on either the first component or my new hat of being kind of rolling out the employees plan.
Well, thank you for your efforts in your talks. I think you've come a long way. I think at this point, and the chair is happy to have you guys turn this over to the committee, and we'll continue to work on the other issues that are outstanding. I did have a question as it related to the unused vacation pay. Do you know what kind of a system cost that was? We'll have to.
I do not know what that was.
Thank you. Somebody knows, huh?
Well, I don't know, Chair Knopp, members of the committee. My name is Beth Ann Darby, and I think actually the PERS staff might be able to provide you with at least a little bit of information. At the January meeting of the PERS board, they discussed a lot of the components of accrued benefits when they had their discussion about what should be included and what should not. And I think that they ultimately decided, if I remember their discussion correctly, was that the administrative cost of tracking a lot of this stuff was more than the cost of including it as part of the retirement benefit. That's sort of how it kind of, it was sort of a circular argument. They discussed it at length. It had to do with the look-back method, but in terms of and what components they were using there. That's sort of where they were.
Perhaps the PERS staff could go back and look at how
we'll get
components.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
But they had some discussions about the numbers, the actual numbers that were used in that time.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Richardson.
Chair, Mr. Lushmet, have you looked at the effect on pricing if the amount of hours that were worked by a part-time employee were to be lifted? I understand that there's a Senate bill that's going to be coming our way that does that, and I understand from some of the school districts that is a cost for them that they would love to see be lessened if a person worked more hours before being qualified for pension benefits, and I'm wondering if that has been looked at in the mix at all.
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, if I'm getting your question correctly, I'm thinking in two different frames. One is post-retirement. You're talking about somebody going ahead and locking in their current pension and then continuing to work above the 1,040?
No, I'm talking about part-time employees that have to be calculated on the defined benefit type plan when they're only working, you know, a few hours a week or whatever.
Representative Richardson, that falls within the 600-hour discussion that we were having, whether or not that's the right break-off point for that. But when you have a defined benefit plan in which the calculation is years of service times the average of the highest 3 years times a multiplier, then what they have as far as final average salary, because they've worked only a certain number of hours, is in fact how the benefit's calculated. So it's obviously, if they're working part-time, they have a much lower final average salary in that calculation.
Okay. Just fine. What I'm really trying to get at is the cost of maintaining a group of people into the plan who may only work a short amount of time. I understand that's the 600-hour rule, but just we're designing a plan, and do we want to, would it make much of an effect if that were to go up? I just was real clear on where that was coming down.
Representative Richardson, actually, the answer to your question is no, we didn't have extensive discussions about that dynamic, and we didn't cost that particular piece out.
If I may, at the Oregon Education Association, we did have a little bit of discussion trying to figure out where did the 600-hour number come from. And the best we could figure out is we have a lot of bus drivers who are our members, and they, many of them, have a two-hour shift in the morning and a two-hour shift in the afternoon to drive buses. And, you know, they work 4 hours every day. That gets you to, based on 175 school days, you take out the non-student contact days, and you get roughly 700 hours. And so we believe that the 600-hour rule was meant to make sure that people that were working half-time in a school job would be covered in PERS if they were to work their regular schedule. And that's just our guess, but when we were trying to back it up and figure out how that number came to pass, that was what we came up with.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, thank you. We're going to recess the hearings on House Bill 2008 and House Bill 2020, open a public hearing on House Bill 2003, and call Ron Parker. Lynn, did you want to come up with them?
Chairman Canope, members of the committee, it's a pleasure for me to be here to address a subject of great interest to the business community. I am the President and Chief Executive Officer of Hampton Affiliates, a lumber company. I'm also the Chair of the Oregon Business Council Public Finance Task Force and a member as well of AOI's Executive Committee. I want to thank you for taking on this enormous issue. I don't believe there's any work before the legislature from a business standpoint that's more important than what you're doing. And I can tell you that the business community, I think, is united in our position that fixing the PERS system is an essential first step in rebuilding Oregon's public finance system and stopping the fiscal drag that the plan will otherwise impose on Oregon's future economy. I appear today in support of House Bill 2003 as an indication of the legislature's desire to fix this serious problem. I particularly want to acknowledge the work of the cities and counties in developing the legislation. We need very bold steps to bring PERS in control and secure the fiscal health of the state. Our schools, public safety, and the quality of all public services depend on getting this right. You know as well as I do that the current and past income replacement rates in the PERS system are far out of line with other public pension plans in the country. and support this policy, employer rates now are high and are scheduled to go much higher in the future. And unless corrected, the rising cost of PERS will eat into the dollars that go directly to for services and ultimately saddle the taxpayers with a burden that's something they cannot bear on top of their own retirement planning. The liability facing Oregon is estimated by personnel at being in excess of $20 billion today, as you know, which is more than $20,000 for every taxpayer of the state. And though affected by market returns, PERS problems are not fundamentally caused by the stock market decline, in our opinion. Rather, the plan is completely unique in the way it in the way asset returns have been credited to Tier 1 employee accounts. The exploitation of certain techniques and uneconomic plan features by the PERS board is the proximate cause of the problems of this plan. As a report by the Frank Russell Company indicated, the plan is unique in that it can raise employer contribution requirements even in a rising stock market. Had the timely warnings of others been heeded, Oregon would now have one of the best funded public retirement systems in the nation. Oregon Investment Council's portfolio performance in the 90s and in the year 2000 was among the best of the large public plans in the country. And even today, despite the market's weakness, the OIC continues to post returns that are excellent relative to the general market. Unfortunately, however, instead of husbanding those extraordinary returns for the inevitable downturn in the market, the PERS board chose, over a period of years, to credit Tier 1 member accounts at a rate nearly twice the market rate of return assumed by their own actuary. In essence, the board ate the seed corn, despite the warnings of the chair and other members of the OIC, over a period of several years. No one, not the OIC nor the PERS board, was charged clearly with the responsibility of looking out for the taxpayer, who is the ultimate obligor of last resort in the plan. Originally, the payroll costs for PERS were expected to be 6% for employers. Today, state officials estimate, as you know, that employers will contribute amounts equal to 20% or more of employee salaries and wages, or about twice the contribution rate of typical plans in other states. Each percentage point increase in the employer's contribution rate increases state general fund spending by $60 million per biennium when the cost to K-12 and community colleges are included. It is likely that this liability will be even higher in the future. A recent projection of rates provided by PERS staff suggests that rates could climb to 30% of payroll early in the next decade. And there's a very real possibility that the state will be required to fund one or more calls amounting to $1.5 billion to $2.5 billion to maintain the system. This is a prescription, as I think you know, for disaster. We appreciate the sincere efforts of the committee for trying to correct the system. I want to applaud you for that effort and tell you that we want to help you. And I hope that you and the legislature and the governor have the backbone to really fix the problem, because we have an extraordinary opportunity at this point in time to deal with a serious threat to the state. We understand that the work you've already done on the mortality tables, on crediting policies and PERS board membership, and we know you intend to do more. As you continue your work, I ask that you be guided by a few principles. First and foremost, the cost of the plan needs to be brought down to a reasonable level. Second, it must be fair to public employees. Pension and other compensation terms should be competitive with the private job market and other states. Also, it must limit as much as possible the liability that's associated with the system now and in the future. We simply cannot afford PERS retirement costs as a percentage of payroll that so far outstrip other systems. We need to set an explicit target in terms of liability reduction and costs as a percent of payroll. By the end of this session, we need to know very clearly what the costs of the system are now and in the long-term future. And finally, it needs to be competitive with other states, and it should also, we think, encourage mobility, both between the private sector and public sector and within the public sector. And it should be transparent to employees, understandable, and if the plan is to have the desired employment effects and the support of the general public, it needs to be much simpler than the system we have now. Indeed, it's lack of transparency of the current plan liabilities that permitted the plan's true condition to be concealed from the public for so long. Now let me turn to House Bill 2003. It offers a series of adjustments to the system designed to bring the cost of PERS more closely in line with systems in other states. In particular, the elimination of the employer match, prospectively will reduce the payouts under the money match system over time and is a modest but important step in reducing system costs. The bill also anticipates adjustments to account balances to reflect the overcrediting that occurred during the 1990s as identified by Judge Lipscomb's decision. It would fix the mortality tables and change board composition and provide outside legal counsel issues that you have addressed in earlier bills. And these steps can generate real savings now. But as I understand it, it's estimated the adoption of this bill will bring the PERS contribution rate down to approximately 11%. Unfortunately, I don't believe that'll happen with the bill as it's currently drafted. Not because there's any fault in those that put it together, but because they have not taken into account the losses in the year 2002 and so far in 2003. In fact, I don't think it can possibly get to 11% without additional work. And I believe the projected rate of 11% is going to be impossible to reach unless we go farther than what this bill contemplates. And for this reason and others, I believe you must not stop here in your examination of the alternatives. The PERS system in Oregon is extraordinarily complex and opaque. Even with these changes proposed by 2003, it is by no means a run-of-the-mill defined benefit pension plan. The current guarantee of an 8% annual rate poses grave risk to taxpayers and public services going forward. As you review the steps in House Bill 2003, we in the business community would like to work with you to compare it to the alternative, which is to cash out the benefits of the existing employees and redirect those dollars into a new plan that is fair, clear, and transparent to all. There is a precedent for shutting down the system and starting over. In 1953, the PERS system was shut down completely for one day and reopened the next to make it compatible with the new Social Security system. Certainly, given the crisis facing our public finance system, we need to consider equally bold steps today. I understand that even if the plan is terminated, the state still faces a deficit in covering accrued benefits of an estimated $7 billion. Any other option that continues the plan almost of necessity will cost more than that. I don't know how we can ask the taxpayers of the state to come up with that money. They've more than paid for a fine retirement system now. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't profess to understand all the details of the retirement system, but I can tell you we need to find real savings now and in the future biennia. House Bill 2003 is a big step forward in that regard. We're prepared to help you assess the costs and benefits of each step as you move forward in this challenge and try to identify savings. And with your help, I'm hopeful that we can find a path that will allow us to be prosperous and successful in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Joe, you want to go ahead and...
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinart of Associated Oregon Industries. I will try to be brief. I want to bring up a few points. First of all, I don't want you to lose sight of the fact that opportunities are here to save millions annually by reforming our current system. Please remember that the taxpayers have high expectations for this committee and the legislation that you will support. They want major savings on PERS. They want PERS savings to help balance our current budget. The business community urges you to get the maximum savings out of House Bill 2003 and get it out of committee as soon as possible. The weight of the PERS system is crushing the state's vitality, and action needs to be taken when you get to that point as quickly as possible so we can meet the deadlines to save the maximum amount of money to get that money in as part of the budget that you're now currently trying to form. And I appreciate the opportunity to say that and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association, and I really hadn't planned to testify today, but I thought there was 2 points that I would like to make. First of all, we'd probably be less than honest if we didn't mostly realize that OBA and AOI, we don't always see the same on everything, and I'm sure there are issues that we can come up with a different position on. But I think that's okay. But I'm here today to show you the solidarity of the business community behind 2003, and I think that's a very important issue. The other thing I want to emphasize is that the reason OBA participated as one of the sponsors of this bill, and we had a healthy discussion about that, is because one of our major planks is K through higher education. That is probably the major plank of Oregon Business Association. And we have always followed the policy of not of saying if we are asking for resources, and the K through higher ed does have a resource problem in our issue, in our opinion, we are not being forthright if we simply say we want more resources, and at the same time we aren't willing to support those issues that will make the system more efficient. And I think that's very important. So we see both sides of the ledger, and we're here today to support 2003 because it brings some immediate revenue to the table, if you will. And I think that's very critical because OBA believes 03, 05, we know how difficult it is for every single one of you up there. And we will be supporting sufficient resources to keep the state from falling off the cliff, if you will. At the same time, we are very supportive of let's find all the savings that we possibly can so that the ongoing system will work. And I'll just finish up by saying this. I'm certainly not an expert on PERS. In fact, I'll give you a little history of why I'm not. When I got in the legislative process, I chose not to participate in PERS because I thought it was a conflict of interest. Well, if I ran my business with making those kind of decisions that cost you that kind of money, I certainly wouldn't be in business today. So from that standpoint, I don't know a lot about PERS, but I know it's a drain on the system that needs to be fixed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I have a question for Ron Parker, a longtime friend with whom it's been my pleasure to work on the retirement arrangements of, I think, three different forest products companies that he's served in over the years. And Ron, welcome to our committee. And I'd like to talk about the level of payroll that the system ought to over the long pull, focusing as we are generally now on the successor system, what we ought to be targeting for. You may have heard in the discussion on the other bills that we had before the committee that we were under discussion of a percentage of payroll as a long-term normal cost of around 8 to 9% of payroll as the employer portion. Now there's a member portion in addition to that that supports the benefits. Is that in your view, in the right order of magnitude for what the system ought to be costing to the employer over the long pull, recognizing, of course, that we're in a hole with the existing system, and so we're not going to see that kind of cost rate soon. But in terms of where we're trying to get to, is that an appropriate order of magnitude?
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, I would say yes, I believe that is a reasonable target. The employer that I work for today, our contribution rate is 7%, including the matching to the 401k. The other employers I've worked for have had defined benefit plans that where the percentage of pay as a contribution towards that plan was in the 8 to 10% range, although based on the extraordinary returns that the stock market had some years ago, in many years there was no contribution required. But a target that's in the range of 7 to 10%, I think, is very reasonable from a private sector perspective. I don't have any experience on the public side.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is actually a question that I'd welcome a response from all of you on, since you come with a united front on behalf of business. I appreciate the comments that you all have all referred to, that the work that this committee does is a significant part of helping balance the state's budget for the upcoming biennium, and your suggestion that we need to look to our employees to help balance that. I come from the perspective that they're partners of this and they need to come to the table and help. My question to you is, as representatives of the business community, what is the business community bringing to the table to help us balance the budget as well?
Fix off that first. Mr. Chairman, Representative Nolan, I think that's a difficult question to answer from the standpoint of the PERS system itself, because as private enterprise we don't participate in the PERS system. But when you, and I think you're talking on a more major approach to that, I was speaking on behalf of OBA, and that's all I'm speaking of now.
Here.
Is the fact that we are watching with a keen eye and are waiting for the co-chair's budget to come out. when the co-chair budget comes out, we want to see what that does for Oregon. And at this point, all I can say is we'll be looking at the... Let me put it back up. The reason we're watching that is because we simply say, from the business climate, for the economic climate, we cannot afford to let Oregon go beyond certain levels, and particularly in public safety, human resources, and education. And so we will be willing to step up to the plate and say, you know, if we have to be part of the solution, in whatever way that happens to be, we'll be here saying that. And I can't be definitive because we're a little bit in the unknown realm at this time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nolan, I think first of all you got to realize this is obviously a difficult task. The state is suffering, but you have to realize that private business is also suffering, and they would like to dig out of the hole also. Mm-hmm. We would like to see the economy doing better, because when the economy gets better, tax revenues get better, and the state does better. I think we're all going to look at any proposal and plan you come up with for getting the state righted and moving forward. And, you know, we have the same priorities. I mean, we think education is very important. We think we need more revenues. We think the state has to level off and move forward again. And we don't want to do anything that would take us further back in the short or long run. So we're going to be looking at anything you come up with to see if we can somehow fit into that to make the state whole without, you know, we don't want to look short term and say, oh yeah, let's do A, B, and C, but it hurts us 3, 4, 5, 6 years out. We think there's a short term as well as a long term solution to keep state in the right path.
I guess I would just add that ultimately it's my belief that there's no such thing as just taxing business. I think ultimately any tax ultimately gets passed through to the ultimate citizens of the state, and that both businesses and the citizens in the state are in a difficult position to come up with more money. From a personal perspective, as I said earlier, I believe that the employers, the taxpayers of this state, have already funded a very nice retirement benefit. There were some bad decisions made that have put us in a terrible bind, and that public employees, by and large, have benefited from those. So I think it is time for them to share more of the cost, or even all of the cost, of trying to fix it, because they've been the beneficiaries of a system that's paying them much more than it was ever designed to pay.
Thank you. Thank you all. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Thank you. Mike, did you want to... Okay. Francis, are you ready?
Sure.
Come on up.
Chair Canope and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify before you again. I really greatly appreciate this. I don't know how much time I have, and I would appreciate it if you'd give me, if I could have 5 minutes, that would help a lot more than three, but that is up to you.
5 minutes will work.
Okay, good. Fine. So I'll do this. And of course, in 5 minutes, I can't hope to give you a full discussion. I can only make statements. And I would urge you to read the written testimony that I have just distributed to you, because that really goes a long way towards developing the rationale and providing the supporting data for the statements that I'm going to make. It's 9 pages, but there are only 4 pages of text, and then 3 figures and 2 tables, so I hope it's not too onerous and you'll find time to read it. I think it would be worthwhile. Now, as has been stated, and I don't want to spend more than 10 seconds on that maybe, President financial crisis. You know, we have a unfunded actuarial liability, which at the end of 2002 is probably $15 or $16 billion. And actually, the first simulation that was latest done in December of 2002 indicates that the employer contribution rates are likely to go up to about 30% from the current 13% in just a few years. You know, this is, of course, an unsustainable situation. And what is the real consequence of that?
Yes.
And I might say, you know, this is a little bit of an answer to Representative Nolan's question. What does business bring to the table? Well, in this case, we have a system which is broken, obviously, and needs fixing. And it's a system that involves employees and employers, all of them public. Okay? And therefore, you might ask, well, we are asking the employees to bring something to the table, what do the employers bring to the table? And I think the employers bring to the table the fact that, again, if their contribution rates goes up to 30%, you know, from the 13% that it currently is for school districts, this is devastating. And actually the result of this, because I don't think we're going to give the taxpayers a bill for $16 billion and expect them to pay that. It's just not going to happen. Therefore, we're going to get whatever money we can from the state, and the only way that we can accommodate this kind of increase in employer costs is to lay off massive amounts, and I really mean massive amounts. We might have to lay off 25% of all public employees in order to pay the increased contribution rates. And if we do this, then we'll cripple all of the government services, and their schools, their public safety, all of these that are essential. So, you know, I think we all have a right to be concerned, and we can say that really we need to fix the system, because the alternative to not fixing the system is the destruction of government services in this state, which would make the quality of life in this state really severely damaged. So, you know, as a board member, I've been a faithful member of OSBA for a number of years, and I've had great expectations for that bill, House Bill 2003. And I must say, you know, of course it is a very broad attempt at reducing the current unfunded actuarial liability. That is by trying to find some ways of implementing Judge Lipscomb's decisions in the courts, and also reducing the cost, if not the certainty, which, because there is a certainty of future financial crises, and this is done by eliminating the 6% employee contribution, which would tend to slow down the growth of the accounts. Okay, and so you can say that those two goals are to me very logical goals, and certainly they would bring a measure of relief. However, as I read the bill a little more carefully, I'm really very disappointed. I really think that, and the main reason for this is that rightly or wrongly, and to avoid controversy or maybe litigation, that the people who crafted the bill 2003 elected to assume that the 8% guarantee, you know, which is a cause of the devastating UALs that we now have, that this 8% guarantee would remain in force in the foreseeable future. And when you take that, then you find that actually House Bill 2003 accomplishes very little, you know, in the short term, and does not protect the state or the system from future crises in the future. And therefore, you know, I'm really very disappointed. I could give you two examples of that, and I'll try to do that very quickly. The first example has to do with the reallocation of 1999 earnings. As you well know, there was a requirement that this Tier 1 should receive at least 8%, but the actual earnings had been 25%, and the PERS board decided to credit 20%. Of course, in doing so, they did not fund the gain loss reserve fund as much as they had decided the month before that they should fund it. But, I mean, this is besides the point. The fact is, so obviously, if the earnings are reallocated, then that would free a lot of money. Now, the logical solution for anybody would be to say, okay, fine, let's go back to the employee accounts and let's just reduce the amount that was credited retroactively from 20% to 8%. Well, you say, well, you can't do that because, you know, these are accrued benefits and you can never do anything to reduce these. And so what they chose to do was to say, okay, we're going to use future earnings, you know, to gradually repay or fund, you know, the cost of reducing this credited earnings from 20% to 8%. Well, the real problem is that, you know, with the 8% guarantee still there, you still have to credit in every future year 8% to these accounts. If there are any earnings that are more than 8%, then because we have liquidated the gain loss reserve fund and because we have a deficit reserve, which is several billion dollars now, earnings above 8%, if there are any, are going to go there first. And therefore, there are not going to be any excess earnings to fund the cost, you know, of reducing the 1999 allocation for at least 10 years, maybe 15. And therefore, you end up with a conclusion, well, sure, we say that we're going to fund that by future earnings, but there are not going to be any future earnings to do this for at least 10 years. And therefore, that means that this really a remedy which, one, is unfair because the employees that are going to accept reduced earnings are not necessarily the same ones as the ones who benefited from the excessive crediting, and also it's ineffective because that's not going to happen foreseeable future. Okay, the other problem that I have is with the 6% guarantee. And 6% employee contribution, I mean. And so it's been stated that, you know, we have a big problem because every employee uses money match, and that the accounts are so large, you know, that the benefits lead to replacement ratios that are unreasonable. We can't afford that because an employer costs. And I think actually that's the wrong analysis. We do not have a high employer cost because of high replacement ratios and high benefits. And all you have to do is look at what happened between 1980 and 1999, and the investment returns were extremely high. They averaged about 15%, you know, and the accounts quadrupled, and the benefits went really up. Replacement ratios went up to about 100% now for 30 years of credited service, but there was no big increase in either unfunded actuarial liabilities or employer costs in all of these years of high investment returns. Now, when you have very low investment returns, then normally the assets should go down, the accounts should go down, the benefits should go down, and again, there would be no increase in United unfunded actuarial liability or in replacement ratios. The thing that happens, though, is that because we have introduced in that system that, to me, arbitrary and ill-thought 8% guarantee, what you have is when you have a combination of low investment returns and the 8% guarantee, that forces you then to increase the liabilities of the system greatly, at the same time that the assets are decreasing. And of course, this causes this unfunded actuarial liability, which, as we've seen, can increase by $6 billion in just 1 year. And so, the fact is, though, that this eliminating 6% employee contribution, if you look at an employee that is close to retirement, close to 30 years or even 20 years of credited service, and his contribution represents 1 to 2% of his account value. The guarantee is 8%. And therefore, that means that 80 to 90% of the growth of that account has nothing to do with his employee contribution. It's just the 8% guarantee on the account return. And therefore, you're not going to appreciably decrease, you know, slow down the growth of the employee accounts for these senior employees. And therefore, you know, it really doesn't do very much good. Eventually, though, as you take the younger employees, where the contribution is a much greater percentage of the growth of the system, then you're going to be in a position where you can, you know, lead all employees to use a formula rather than money match. But then you have one third of the school districts, and mine is included, in which we do not pick up the employee contribution. I mean, they make their own contribution out of their own paycheck, and we make the employer contribution at 13% now. Well, when everybody retires on a formula, and if we've eliminated the 6% contribution from employees, that means that the employer contribution has to be jacked up by that amount so that the system is in balance. And therefore, this will result for us in an increase of our employer costs. So then we see in that bill, you know, very little benefit in the short term and added cost in the long term. So then what I would say, though, based on this is that, you know, House Bill 2003 is good. I mean, I don't have anything that I particularly agree or dispute about the bill, but it is really a bill which does not protect the state or the state agencies or employers from disastrous, because this is what the 8% guarantee does. And therefore, if we really want to put the system on a sustainable and sound basis, which protects both employees and employers and the state in the future, we have to do something about the 8% guarantee. If we don't do that, then that system is not fixed and we're going to pay the problems. And I'm very encouraged that Governor Kulongoski, in fact, recently indicated that he thought that actually that 8% guarantee was a big problem for PERS and should be reexamined and perhaps eliminated. And finally, you know, even if we do all of this and we have all of these bills, 2003, 2004, 2005, and a new bill which I hope will come to eliminate the guarantee, we still have the possibility that none of these bills are going to survive either the legislature or the courts. And if that happens, then the only thing we can do is just terminate the system. And I'm also encouraged there that this is something that Governor Kulongoski thought was a possibility. Scrapping PERS and starting anew was something that would meet his major goals. And I'm also very surprised but pleased that Don Morgan, who was the chair of the PERS board and was the president of the OPEU, when it was called OPEU a long time ago, said exactly the same thing. In fact, she said, "I personally believe that if we want to get out of the mess we're in, it requires termination of the old system, which is too convoluted to be reformed." And so, you know, this is just my point. I like Bill 2003, but frankly, it does very, very little for me, and it doesn't protect the system or the state. And therefore, I would like to see a bill to eliminate the 8% guarantee. I think that would really fix the system. And if we can do that, then maybe we have to look at termination of the system. And I appreciate the hard work you do, and I wish you success.
Thank you, Francis. When did the governor say that he'd be willing to terminate the system? Do you remember? Because I don't remember him saying that. I remember saying he would get rid of the 8% guarantee.
But no, I think that was actually a statement that was made, and I probably have it.
You don't have to give it to me.
No, at one time, now, but he was interviewed on that, and he said, let's see, let me find it exactly. I mean, let me tell you exactly what he said. And I'm going to get it in just a second. Okay, Governor Kulongoski, in his recent PERS policy address. Now, when I wrote that, that was probably several weeks ago, so that would have been sometime in February. I think he had a major address in which he dealt with PERS policy, and he cited two major proposals which met his goals of saving taxpayer money while protecting worker pensions: House Bill 2003 was one of them, even though I don't think anybody does that. And the other one was all scrapping PERS and starting anew. I wasn't at that press conference, so I just heard that. I read it in either the Statesman's Journal or the Oregonian.
Okay. I think we just have a different interpretation of what he said, because I think by scrapping the system, I don't know that he meant ending it completely for current employees, because I haven't heard him articulate that beyond saying scrapping the system, but I think he meant starting a new system for new hires. But I'd be happy to ask him that question and get back to you.
Frankly, I think it's important, because the one thing you can say is that when you talk about a successor plan, you know, or a system for future employees, that doesn't do anything about the structural problems in the current system for current employees. You are not complete. Look at what you did in 1996 when you had Tier 2 employees.
No, don't be blaming me for that.
No, I'm sorry. I say you, not you.
Even think any of us were here.
No, okay. Well, I'm relieved.
But we understand where you're headed with it. Anybody else have questions? Thank you very much, Francis.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Doug Smith? We're back for more, Doug. You enjoyed it so much the last time. That's great. We were probably too kind to you, huh?
I'm a member of PERS employees, but PERS retirees, but not speaking for them. The first item I'd like to kind of ask questions about and raise objection to would be Section 3 of 2003, where you eliminate cost of living increases for employees only who are retired between 1996 and 2003. That seems, first of all, it's wrong. It's wrong, especially to only select those people and cut out their cost of living increases. It certainly hurts some of them. The second part is section, first of all, I can't understand the bill I'm doing. I'm taking all of this off of Mr. Gary's interpretation of a bill he wrote. I have grave questions about Section 7 that tries to eliminate variable annuity part of the PERS retirees. The people who put their money, especially those who put 75% of variable annuities, benefit enormously from being able to put their money in the stock market and see it rise up, and will be able to get higher amounts from that. The higher PERS benefits that you're all complaining about come from two things, mainly variable annuities and the money max. The next part is Section 9, and I don't know if I'm right or wrong here, but I'm reading right off of Mr. Gary's interpretation of the bill. He says, and this deals with, I'm not too sure what Section 9 deals with, but anyway, it reads, it limits the amount that can be credited to Tier 1 member accounts to the assumed rate unless all reserves are sufficient to meet all expected obligations of the employer, including future interest credited at the assumed rate. I hope that doesn't mean you're going to take Tier 1 account money and use it to pay the obligations of the employers. If you do that, it would be equivalent to massive theft, really. You'd be taking a lot of money, maybe in the billions of dollars. Well, if you just go over a dollar amount, so I'm taking this from the Employee Association's testimony. If you prevent participation for members, it'll cost apparently $1.9 billion. That's a lot of money. If you withhold annual cost of living increases for those between October 14th, 1996, and to January 1st of 2003, that's another $1.6 billion. And then if you pay for the court decision by a rather bizarre use of the word administrative expense, you're talking about another $1.9 billion. And it just, and it appears that your old legislative council has grave doubts about using PERS money to pay for the court decision as an administrative expense. These are substantial amounts of money and not just paying for Xerox paper and the telephone bills and things. Thank you. So.
Thank you. Any questions? Thanks, Doug. Appreciate you coming back. Anyone else want to testify on House Bill 2003? We actually didn't give the unions any of their invited testimony time. Did you guys want to say anything more? Well, Mary, you're the only one that's scheduled to testify in the next three bills, so maybe you want to come up and say something about House Bill 2003. And I thought Ashley was supporting the bill, so you might want to come up and clarify.
I don't think it's a good idea.
All right.
Well, I'm really trying to, so I don't think it's a good idea.
All right. We'll close the public hearing. Me too, by the way. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2003. And did anybody want to testify on the successor plan bills?
Like Mary.
No, she. We're going to close the public hearing on 2008, close the public hearing on 2020, open public hearings on 3025, 3433, and 2407. And Mary, you are the only one signed up currently to testify in those, so why don't you come on up and share your crankiness with us.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Botkin, and I don't know whether I'm testifying for myself or for my organization, so I'll just, like, leave it at that. But I think I'm representing AFSCME Council 75. I just want to say generally that I think this is a bad idea. I think taking legislators out of PERS does a couple of things. It ignores the value of the work that they bring here, and it ignores either past or future public service that they may provide to the state of Oregon, and it eliminates an amazing amount of people from consideration of ever serving here. And folks who are in the PERS system, whether they're elected officials or hired employees, have value in public service, and to ask them to give up significant amounts of their time that account now towards their retirement, I think is not appropriate, and I don't think it saves much. You have, if you feel some compelling reason to opt out, you have the right now to opt out. If you want to continue with your 401k, you can do that now. And to shut a door without really, I would not suggest you haven't thought it through, but, I'm thinking about, there's a lot of people who are in the building today that served a lot of years in this building as legislators and, in both parties. And I just think it's not a good plan.
And they've all been asking whether or not it's just going to be retroactive, by the way.
Well,
I've assured them that it won't be retroactive to those who are
retired. I'm thinking about folks like Tony Van Vliet, who spent years and years and years and years down the hall balancing budgets for the state of Oregon and a professor at the Oregon State University. Why ask him to make that kind of a choice? We need that kind of quality in this building. And I don't think you want to close the doors on those kinds of people. And it doesn't matter whether they're Democrats or Republicans. People bring value here. And if they're elected officials, if they're county commissioners or city commissioners, or, water board commissioners, for goodness sakes, we ought to bring them here because Lord knows that we need all the smart we can get in this building right now. And
are you suggesting there's not enough smart here already?
I'm saying that there's always room for more smart. So, I'm the only one that's going to testify against this, and, it doesn't really matter. It's not my fight. It's not my dog. And, the first rule I always heard was, if you don't have a dog in the fight, stay out. But, you know, I just think it doesn't make a lot of sense, and I think it diminishes your importance, and I don't think that's the right thing to do.
Well, you know, I would be happy to share my thoughts with you as to why I think it is necessary. And I have thought it through, and the one fact I can't get around is clearly, I don't see how you get around the fact that it's a conflict of interest for us to sit in judgment of the plan and vote on the plan, and clearly legislators have given themselves a pretty good deal over time and put themselves in police and fire and those types of things. And I understand that happened at a time when they were trying to professionalize the legislature and to raise pay and to do things to attract people. And I just I guess I can't get around the fact that the public is calling for more accountability, more efficiency. The one thing that consistently shows up in surveys is that they believe that government is wasting their money and that legislators are in PERS and have a conflict of interest. We hear that continually. And I don't know any way to remedy that situation unless you take legislators out of PERS. And I'm perfectly willing to find an alternate retirement plan, but I just don't see how we can stay in the general plan that that firefighters and other public employees, general service employees, are in.
Mr. Chair, if I can,
yeah.
I would eliminate your ability to be in police and fire.
No,
I've
right.
never seen any argument for that. But I think to acknowledge the public's question about your credibility or our credibility as a system by allowing them to think that they were right, by questioning your ability to make good decisions about the system simply because you're in it, is an insult to you and to us and to our system. And I just don't think, Mr. Chair, I have never had any of you in all my years in this building look at what's good for you over what's good for the system and what's good for the state of Oregon and what's good for the people who live here. And I think that we should not encourage people to think that you would do any less than that now. And I'm sorry, I just, it's not my experience with legislators, whether I agreed with you or I didn't agree with you or whether we thought the same, it's not my experience that you all vote based on what's good for your pocketbook. And you know what? 6 months out of every 24 doesn't pad your pocketbook much.
Okay. No, we're still making, 1,283. Well, maybe we are overpaid.
You know,
down to 1250.
Mr. Chair, you make my point for me. You know, I think a decent retirement system, even if you don't ever benefit from it, is the least the state of Oregon can offer to you for the service you give them. These people expect you to work 24/7 all the time for $1,200 a month, and you know, a retirement system that you may or may not ever get a piece of the action of, you know? I mean, as I said, it's not my fight. I'm not going to do floor letters. I'm not going to, you know, I just had to say this because I just think it's important that we keep you in PERS, not because other reason than you earn it.
I appreciate the fact that you have that viewpoint, and, you know, you're one of 3.5 million Oregonians, so, 3.49999 Oregonians to go, and we will have a lot of people believing that we have significant value here. But
well, you have people that believe you make $100,000 a year in this building,
and
too,
that's
and
why
you know they would be wrong about that too.
That's why I said I take every opportunity I can to tell people that we make $1,283 a month.
Yeah.
That has been cut nearly $100 a month, roughly 7.5%.
I understand
over this last year. Because people do believe that, you know, we work in Washington, D.C., and we have $150,000 a year income, which is not true.
Not true. And so, you know, I guess, you know, I may be the only person who feels this way. And, you know, sometimes it just doesn't matter if you're the only person that feels this
way. No, you're not the only one, I don't think. But
what? Oh, there's six of us? You know, clearly nobody else is going to stand up here or get up here and testify in favor of keeping you in. And, you know, I just know that 90% of the people sitting behind me are in PERS. I want you to know, I'm not in PERS. I've never been in PERS. And I've been in this building for 18 years, and I've never been in PERS. So, you know?
Yep.
You ought to stay in. That's all I have.
Well, the rest of us need to join Greg McPherson, I guess. And he's not in it either, so.
I was thinking about AOI myself, but, you know, what can I say?
I guess we all had that choice.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It is a choice. Elected officials under the statute have the opportunity to either opt in or to stay out, and I have opted to stay out for just the reason that you cited, that the concern about whether there's a conflict of interest, considering the sort of major things we've got going on this time. But so I take, a more disinterested view, and I had one question I wanted to ask Mary, and that is, do you see a connection between the public attitude about taking legislators out of PERS, and I think that probably there would be broad public sentiment in favor of that, and the impulse toward term limits, and how do you see the effects of term limits and the effects of sort of less continuity in the legislature impacting the political process in the state?
Well, as one of the Representative McPherson, as one of the folks who joined the effort to overturn term limits, I don't favor term limits either. I think there's quality and experience. Maybe that's because I started with, you know, being able to do this in 2-inch heels all day long and, you know, not such white hair. And I do think that there's value in white hair. And I think there's value in experience. And I think that it takes a long time to figure out how the process works and how to influence a process to the benefit of all Oregonians. So I never supported term limits, don't support them now. And, you know, the citizens have been, it's easier to think with bumper stickers than it is to think through a process. And if you appeal to people's lowest common denominator, then they will never rise above it. And I do believe we have to ask them to rise above it. And that requires that we talk to them and that we have real conversations. And I don't think we should lower our level of thinking to theirs, that we should ask them to come up to a higher level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Anyone else wishing to testify on any of our take legislators out of PERS bills? Nope. Close the public hearing on 3433, 3425, and 2407. I believe that ends our agenda for today. Thank you, committee members. We're going to work on, I believe we'll put 2003 back on the schedule for public hearing, possible work session on Tuesday. And we'll also put the new plan bills on, as well as House Bill 2407. I think that's the vehicle we'd use to do this. And if you have any, again, I ask, if you have any amendments that you'd like to put in that bill, please bring them to me. It's really my intent to provide another option, probably an optional retirement plan for legislators that is privately administered. And if you have other thoughts, I'm obviously interested, but I think we need to have the amendments drafted and move forward and continue to have testimony on the successor plans and hopefully get some more information about what the employers have done and move forward on those three bills, 2003 and one of the successor plan bills and the legislator bill next week. I don't know that we'll put them all out next week, but I think we need to be working them with the intent to move them shortly because we do have a time frame that we need to meet as it relates to PERS. May 1st is really that time frame, and I want to give the Senate ample time to do what they need to do. And some of these bills actually may need to have a stop in Ways and Means due to fiscals. We're looking at that aspect of it too. So with that, if there's no other questions, thank you, and committee adjourned.